The following podcast is from the weekly message at Summit Church in Upstate South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Is it real? Is the story we tell ourselves about this Christian life we're living, is it just a wonderful tale we tell? Is there really something there in the there that we say? Is it real? I mean, do you never wonder about that? Do you come to the end of a long week or maybe facing an obstacle that you don't see a way around, or maybe the shadow of suffering is falling over your life, and life seems more puzzling and more challenging and less satisfying than you imagined the Christian life to be? And don't you ever have those questions where it rises in your soul, you go, is this real? I mean, is this the abundant life that Jesus was talking about? Am I telling myself the truth? And then you pause and you do kind of an internal check. And in an honest moment, when you look into your own soul, you try to take the read of your own heart, you go, well, there's some affection for Jesus. But when you're honest, it's just kind of tepid. I mean, we just sang about adoring him. And you always feel that, right? No, sometimes it's just like, well, there's some feelings there. And then you look at how your life is playing out in your relationship with others, in your relationship with him, your journey in faith. And you go, well, I think something is happening there. I think something is happening there. But it isn't life-altering cosmic power that you're experiencing, and you're left just going, is this real? Or am I just telling myself a story that will help me sleep better at night? Like religious people do all over the world. They spin a tale to help them make sense of their world. Do you not ever wonder those things? I know some of you do, because I've been journeying with believers for a long time. And although we don't want to admit it, sometimes those questions come up and go, is this real? Is this life that I'm living, is this the abundant life that Jesus procured for me? Or am I just going through the motions, singing songs that I wish were true, about great affection and transformative power? So I sing the words with a hope that maybe listening to those words, there'll be some change. And I tell myself that this is the Christian life, and I still wonder, this is it? Am I just telling myself a story to make it easier to fall asleep at night? I'd like to be of help to you this morning. I want to be of help to me as well. I mean, because I feel these things. I have these questions. These thoughts run through my mind and through my heart. And I expect through the hearts and minds of many of you at various times and places in life. But my words are not the transformative words. So my words are not the ones that are going to bring about change. The words that are going to be helpful are the words from this book. So we're going to continue in our journey through the book of Revelation. We've been walking through chapters 1, 2, and 3, listening to what Jesus says to believers, to churches. And although he is speaking to particular churches at a particular time, in a particular setting in Asia Minor, what he says to them, if we listen, he actually has something to say to us as well. Jesus' words are the words we need to hear. My words are not. Jesus' words are the words you need to hear this morning. And so, again, I'm going to pray, because we need assistance. Then we're going to read, then we're going to think, and then we're going to ask Jesus to speak to us this morning in this place. So Again, let's pause for just a minute to pray. There was a church in Philadelphia, Jesus, that needed to hear from you, and you dictated a short letter to John to deliver to them with life-giving, life-changing words. And this morning we're going to read somebody else's mail, a letter that didn't come directly to us. It came to us by way of Philadelphia, but the things that you said to them, I need to hear this morning. And my friends in this room, they need to hear from you this morning. And so would you move in and through my heart and my lips, and would you speak through your word by your spirit to these saints for their good, for the spread of your glory. Do something here that cannot be done just because we met together with one another, but do something that could only happen because you met with us. This needs to happen. I'm longing for this, and I'm asking for it in your name and for the spread of your fame. Amen. Book of Revelation. That's where we've been. That's where we're going to continue to be. Friends, live in the book. So bring a copy of the scriptures, open the book, read the book. These words are the words that matter. Can't hear that enough. Revelation chapter 3. I'm going to read the words, but you need to follow along. You need to become familiar with these words yourself. Revelation chapter 3. I'm going to start in verse 7. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, and who shuts and no one opens. I know your works. Behold, I've set before you an open door, which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. Because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to try those who dwell on the earth. I'm coming soon. Hold fast what you have so that no one may seize your crown. The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Well, this is a letter. It's in New Testament language, it's an epistle. Letters in this day were sent, and unlike us, where there's an envelope and tells you who it comes from and who it goes to, the letter would start with a greeting and an identification of the author. Paul's letters all start this way. If you read Paul's letters, the epistles, you'll notice that he doesn't always identify himself the same way when he's writing. Because to certain churches, he's emphasizing certain things about his call and his role in their life. Sometimes he identifies himself as an apostle, sometimes as a servant. And so in each of these seven letters, Jesus is identifying himself, saying something about himself that's fitting and appropriate to the recipients of the letter. So here he's writing this letter, dictating it to John, to the church in Philadelphia, and he identifies himself in a really particular way. And so we need to be attentive to the things he says about himself here. Notice four things that Jesus says about himself as he's speaking to the church in Philadelphia. First, he says, the words of the Holy One. Now we tend to think holy means like God, absolutely. But the word holy doesn't simply mean godlike. The opposite of holy is not necessarily sinful. The common antonym, the common opposite of holy in the Old Testament is common. Something that was holy was unique, set apart, special. Something that was not holy was common and ordinary. So when Jesus identifies himself as the Holy One, it's not wrong to think he's identifying himself with God, because God is absolutely unique and there's no one else like him. But the idea is Jesus is unique, marvelous, set apart. He identifies himself as the Holy One and then says, the true one. Here's what the words of the Holy One and the true one. So that means he's both the one who is dependable, true, sound, reliable, but also the one who speaks truth. So the unique one, the true one. And then he says, the one who has the key of David. Now that's a puzzling image. I had to do a little digging to see what that might mean. There's only one reference to the key of David in all the scriptures besides this text. It comes in the in a rather obscure reference in Isaiah chapter 22 about a servant in the household of the king and was given the key of David to hold responsibility. Well, if you think about David as the one who was identified as God's handpicked king and through whom would come a son like David, a king like David, the idea of the key of David is one who has the right to rule like a king. So he says he's the true one, he says he's the holy one, he says he's the one who has the key of David, he's the rightful king. And then he says, who opens and no one will shut, and who shuts and no one opens. Now that's a fascinating metaphor, and what's the idea there? Well, for him to be the one who opens and no one shuts, and who shuts and no one opens, I think Jesus is saying he does what he wants, as he wants, however he wants, without ever having any opposition. Jesus is saying, I get to do what I want, and no one can oppose it. So we need to see Jesus this way. If we're going to listen and hear well what he says to the church in Philadelphia, we need this picture of Jesus, because Jesus is identifying himself this way. He's the unique one who speaks the truth. He is the one set apart and who sovereignly does whatever he wants. And no one can oppose him. And that's the Jesus who speaks to the church in Philadelphia. And he starts by telling them, I know some things about you. So did you notice the things he says he knows about them? He starts by saying, I know your works. He recognizes their labor. They've done stuff. Now, he doesn't laud their works. He doesn't, in some of the letters, he talks about the grandeur of the works. He simply says here, I know your works. Their work was not unrecognized by him. It might have been little, it might have been much, but Jesus is willing to say to the Philadelphian church, I know what you've done. I'm aware. I'm attentive. I've seen. I know. And he says, I know your works. And he does say that I know you have but little power. In verse 8, I know you have but little power. I don't think that's dismissive. I don't think Jesus is going, yeah, not much. I don't think he's dismissing them. I think he's acknowledging that as he looks at them and they think of themselves, they have, quote, little power. Now, there's some question as to what it might refer to, this little power. Some think it might mean they have little influence in the city. But I don't see that language typically used. The language of power is typically used about spiritual power, the work of the Spirit in and through them, both in their lives and in the lives of others. And so it might well be that Jesus is saying, he's not dismissive. He goes, you've got some power, but not much. You've done some work, but not much. I know that there's not a lot going on. But you've done some work and you have some power. And then he does say, verse 10, he also knows that they have kept his word. They have not denied his name. That's what he says in verse 8. You have kept my word and not denied my name. Verse 10, you have kept my word. So what does this mean? Well, in some of the letters to the seven churches, there are churches that are facing massive persecution. There's no clarity here that the church in Philadelphia is facing massive persecution. But he does say, I know that you've welcomed, kept, held on to my word, and you've not denied me. But when I think about that, that's kind of baseline stuff. You know, a believer is someone who has received Jesus' words and welcomed the gospel, and didn't deny him. Perhaps they're facing persecution, but it's not explicit. Basically, Jesus is saying, you've embraced what I've said to you. You've welcomed what I've said to you. You aren't resistant to speaking out in my name. You've welcome the truth. For me, I'm thinking, well, this is baseline. Every believer, this is true about. So when I put these things together, I know your works. You have little power. And you believe. You've embraced the message. This is what he acknowledges about them. He knows this about them. But it's not a huge lauding, but a recognition of what's true about what's going on in the church of Philadelphia. And then he talks with them about what he's going to do. So notice what he's going to do for this church. He says in verse 8, behold, I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. Literally, I've given you this door. This door is now, I've given this to you. So the question is, so what is Jesus speaking about when he's talking about this, I have given you an open door. I've set before you an open door that no one's going to be able to shut. Initially, it must mean, minimally it must mean, Jesus is doing something in and through the church that cannot be opposed or overthrown. But I have to ask, so what's the open door? Like, you get to leave Philadelphia. No, I don't think that's what he's talking about. The open door, you can go through a number of texts in the New Testament and look at that language, that picture of an open door. Back in Acts chapter 17, Luke tells us that the Lord opened a door of faith for the Gentiles to believe. And in writing to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 9, Paul writes and says that a wide door was opened for his labors. And writing to the Colossians, Paul writes to the Colossians and asks them to pray that God would open up a door for the word. So it seems like this picture of an open door means there's an opportunity for life and ministry. So Jesus is saying, he's picturing for the Philadelphian church, I am opening up a door, an opportunity for you to live well and to share the message. I'm doing this. I'm creating an opportunity for you to live out this life well and to have ministry opportunity. He's doing that. And then there's this really interesting thing that he says, starting in verse 9. I will make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie, behold, I will make them come and bow down before you. Now, that first time, the first word make is the same word give. I'm going to give them to you. I'm going to give them to you. Now, we've already encountered the synagogue of Satan language earlier in one of the other letters. There is a little ambiguity there. We're not quite sure exactly what's being spoken of. Clearly, it's a gathering of those who apparently are not embracing the gospel. Now, you wouldn't call the synagogue of Satan a competing church. We wouldn't go. There's lots of other synagogues of Satan that you could go to on Sunday mornings. We're really glad that you've chosen to be here. No, that's not the idea. So clearly, a group that is not embracing the gospel, but we don't see any direct opposition here. But Jesus says, I'm gonna give them to you, and they're going to come and bow before you. Jesus is going to do something to those who are the opponents of the gospel, and he's going to bring them. Jesus doesn't tell the church in Philadelphia, you need to go and get them. He says, I'm going to give them to you, and they're going to come and bow before you. And then he says, I've opened a door. I've opened a door. I'm going to give the opponents to you. And then look at the last thing he says he's going to do for them. In verse 10, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to try those who dwell on the earth. I will keep you from the hour of testing or the hour of trial. Now, Jesus says, when he's talking to his disciples in the upper room, he says, if they hated me, they're going to hate you. Jesus explains to the disciples that in this world, you will have trouble. You're going to have difficulty. There's going to be opposition. So when Jesus here is speaking to the church in Philadelphia and says, I'm going to keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world, I don't think that he is saying, you're not going to endure any hardship. There's never coming any persecution your way. In fact, he says that because you have kept my word, I will keep you. Same word used. When it says that they kept his word, that means they embraced, they held on to, they didn't let go of what he'd said to them. And so when he says, I'm going to keep you, I think he's not saying, I'm going to deliver you from ever having to experience any persecution or suffering. But I'm going to hold tightly to you in the midst of all of that. I'm going to keep you in the midst of all that. It's the very kind of thing that Jesus says to the disciples in the upper room in John chapter 17, verse 15. When he's praying for his friends, for believers. He's in fact praying for everyone who comes to faith, and he's praying to the Father, and he says, I'm asking you not to take them out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one. Well, clearly not to be taken out of the world, not to be taken out of the persecution, not to be taken out of the trouble. When Jesus says, I'm asking you to keep them, Father, that means to hold on to them, to preserve them in the midst of whatever they might be going through. So Jesus, the third thing that he says he's going to do for the church in Philadelphia, I'm going to keep you. I'm going to hold on to you. Even in the midst of whatever's coming, I'm holding on to you. So some things about Jesus, what he knows about them, the church in Philadelphia, and the things that he is doing. And then as I'm listening to Jesus speak here, I want to ask a question. So what's going to become evident? What will be the outcome of all of this? I'm sure you heard it. Read again, verse 9. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. That's really remarkable in my mind. He doesn't say, they're going to come and they're going to know how great your love is for me. He doesn't say that. He says, I'm going to make it happen so that those who are the opponents of the gospel, it will be clear to them that you are the objects of my great love. He doesn't say, and they're going to be aware of your great love for me. He says, I'm going to make it really clear that you are the objects of my great love. I'm working in such a way that even the opponents of the gospel will recognize that you are the objects of my great love. And then he explains more about what he's going to do. Look in verse 12 and following. To the one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down from God out of heaven, and my own name. You're going to get scribbled on. You're going to have his name on you and the name of his God and the name of the new Jerusalem and the new name. What's the idea there? What is Jesus saying to them? If in fact, explaining that he's going to bring the opponents of the gospel to bow before the believing so that even the opponents will recognize that the church in Philadelphia, these believers are loved by God. This is bigger and huger than this. All of creation is going to know that they belong to him. They'll be marked out by his. It'll be clearly obvious that these believers belong to him. His name is on them. They are identified with him by his doing. It's not that you've identified with me. I'm identifying with you. I'm going to make it clear that I have identified with you. It's not your great love for me. It's my great love for you that's going to be seen. It's not that you've identified with me. It's that I've identified with you. That's what Jesus wants the church in Philadelphia to recognize. And he calls them very simply to one thing. Verse 11, hold fast to that which you have. Hold fast to that which you have. What do they have? Well, a little power. A message that they've embraced. His words that they're holding on to. He simply says, hold on to that. Hold on to that. The call is just to stay the course. That's it. Hold on to that. But are they at risk? I think sometimes reading these letters, that's a huge question. Are they at risk? Look at what he says to the one who conquers. Verse 12, to the one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. Could sound conditional. Sometimes sounds conditional. We read it that way sometimes. If in fact you do get your act together enough to conquer, then you'll be a pillar. Then I'll put my name on you. But I don't think that is what Jesus is saying here. He's already said to them, I have given you an open door that no one can shut. Something's going on with them, right? He's already said that. He's already said that he will make their opponents come and acknowledge that they are the objects of his love. Those things are certain. So when Jesus says to him who conquers, I don't think there's uncertainty there. That expression, to the one who conquers, it's literally the conquering one, is a pillar. And the question then is, how does someone conquer? What is Jesus calling for there? How does one become a conqueror? How does one become an overcoming one? John, in another place, helps me here. I'm looking at 1 John chapter 5, where he writes and says, everyone who has been born of God overcomes. 1 John chapter 5, verse 4. Everyone who has been born of God overcomes, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. Verse 5, who is it that overcomes the world except the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God? Well, hey, do the believers in Philadelphia believe? They do. Have they welcomed the word? They have. Have they embraced the truth? Indeed. Are they overcomers? Absolutely. This is not a conditional. This is a certainty. To the one who overcomes, the overcoming one is the one who believes. And Jesus has already affirmed to the church in Philadelphia, I know. You have a little power, but you have work. You've embraced my word. You've not denied my name. I know. And I'm going to make you a pillar. And I'm going to put my name on you. Those of the faith, that is, those who have believed, those who are born again, are by their very nature of being new in Christ. They are the conquerors. They are the overcomers. Not by their strength, but by his doing. So then if this is the case, I ask a question. If Jesus fully knows, he fully knows their labor. But even that seems to be of little power. He fully knows their situation in life with the synagogue of Satan, but they're living it out in the midst of opposition. He knows they have some faithfulness, they have held on, but he intends for his love to be seen in them, that they are the object of his love, to become evident. He is assuring them, you're going to make it. He's assuring the church in Philadelphia, you're going to make it. That's pretty amazing. But when I see that, I want to ask the question, why say these things to this church? Why say these things to the church in Philadelphia? Why call them to hold on to what they have? Why tell them the opponents are going to come and acknowledge that you are the objects of my love? Why announce to them that you will be pillars and you will bear my new name? Why tell them this? Because I think they need the reassurance. I think they need to hear it. As I read this letter, I'd like to suggest that they need this reassurance because they feel so little power. They know. They only have little power. And I think they need this reassurance because they wonder at times whether Jesus just benignly puts up with them or whether he really does love them. I think the reason why this letter comes is because they wonder, is this real? Is this real? Is this Christian life that we say we are living, is it just a wonderful story we're telling ourselves? Is it real? We feel so weak. We don't seem to have much power. We don't feel much of a surpassing power that's transforming our world. We know that we have believed in him. But sometimes we don't feel and taste his great love for us. We sing songs that we know we should be singing, but we don't always feel it. So Jesus tells them, you are mine and you will be mine forever. You are secure, not because of your great power, but because of my great power. You are safe, not because of your great love for me, but because of my great love for you. And that's going to be seen, and I'm going to do it. And that's what you need to know. What does that mean for us? What does that mean for me and you? Spiritual reality, that is spiritual health, is not anchored in my power to live the Christian life well, or in the depth of my love for Christ. But spiritual health is anchored in his power to work on our behalf to his end, and is anchored in his great love for us. Our grasp of the reality, the realness of the Christian life, does not come through looking deeply at ourselves, but by fixing our gaze upon Jesus. That's what's being called for here. I know you don't have much power. I know there's some works, but it doesn't seem to be very significant. I know that you're living in a place where it's not been changed very much, but you need to know I'm at work Set my love on you. It's going to be evident. Spiritual health is not anchored in my power to live out the Christian life well or because of the greatness of my love for Christ, but spiritual health is anchored in his power at work in our lives on our behalf because he's doing it and his great love for us. Our grasp of reality does not come through looking deeply at ourselves, but by looking and fixing our gaze upon Jesus. The book of Hebrews, the author says, we run this race by fixing our eyes upon him who is the author and finisher of our faith. In Romans, Paul writes and says, what can separate us from the love of Christ? But I have only a little power and I don't feel much love, but nothing of that is ever going to separate you from the love of Christ because this is what he's done. In John chapter 3, John writes and says, behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called the children of God, and such we are. And brethren, it does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know when we see him, we will be like him because of your great power and your great love, right? No. But because of his great love and his great power, this new life that you enjoy because the Spirit opened your eyes to see how magnificent Jesus was. And the Father then drew you to that Jesus. And as you fixed your eyes upon that Jesus, there's a divine conspiracy that happens. And the Father and the Son and the Spirit conspire together to give you new life. And the life is then lived that same way by looking to him who has both the power to transform you and the love to hold on to you. It is not your power or even our affection for Christ. It is his power and his affection for us. Jesus is saying to the church in Philadelphia, I have the keys. I have the keys. I'm the king. I open the doors for your life and no one can shut that. I will make others come and acknowledge my love for you. I'm going to keep you. I will make you a pillar in the temple of my God. I am putting my name on you. You are mine. He says to his disciples, John chapter 15, you didn't choose me. I chose you. And I have appointed you to bear fruit, and your fruit will remain. The reality and the realness of the Christian life is not found in looking inside, but looking at him who is sovereign and gracious and powerful and purposeful. And he has set his love on you. Here's what I want to invite you to do. I want you to close your Bibles. I want you to close your eyes, not because you have to pray, but I want you to close your eyes. And I want you to lean in. And in the eyes of your heart, you have senses by which you can see spiritual realities. In the eyes of your heart, I want you to turn your attention from you for a moment this morning. Turn your attention from you. No self-assessment about how much love there is there, how much power there is there. I want you to turn your attention from you and just let the truth of how great and powerful Jesus is and how great and magnificent his love is. I want you to turn and see him. I want you to look to him. I want you to settle in there. I want that to wash over you. The worship team is going to sing a new song. I want you to have a quiet moment to hear what the Spirit is saying to the church in Philadelphia and to the church in Greenville.
For this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. For more information about Summit Upstate and other available resources, check out our website at summitupstate.org.